Hi everybody, today's Friday, July 4th, 2025, and our friend Dmitry Orlov is back with us. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Good to be with you once again.
Dmitry, today's July 4th, and you mentioned that you have a new note, a new piece on your website. Let us know about it.
Yes, please go to boosty.to/clubOrlov, C-L-U-B-O-R-L-O-V. And there's a blog in honor of 4th of July holiday in the United States, Independence Day, which I made freely available to anyone and everyone. It's called How Donald Went to War. And it's an homage to Kurt Vonnegut, a great American writer. I hope you enjoy it. Please go there. And if you like it, please consider subscribing so that you can read all of my other articles that are on that blog. I publish one or two a week.
Yeah, I do suggest, please go there and support Dmitry for what he's doing. It's amazing. And Dmitry, let's start with what has happened during the call between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. And it seems that Donald Trump is not happy with the outcome, with the way that he did talks, the sort of idea on the part of Vladimir Putin about the conflict in Ukraine was somehow developing during the more than 3 years of the conflict. He still says that it's Biden's war. I don't know what does that mean. He's the president of the United States. What does he want to get from Vladimir Putin that he's not capable of or he's not able of?
Well, he can't have an outright Russian victory, which is what's going to happen. Whether it's Biden's war or not Biden's war, he can't have Russia win because it'll still be NATO's loss, and the U.S. is part of NATO, biggest part of NATO. Without the U.S., NATO is nothing. So he can't really afford to have it look like a major defeat for the West and a major victory for Putin, which is what it's going to be, because it was a harebrained idea to begin with, to use the Ukrainians to overthrow Putin. You know, it's somebody with 80% approval rating throughout Russia, and so he keeps saying the same thing. You know, he's just not really capable of processing new information. He isn't really capable of understanding that there isn't a deal to be made because he's not part of it, because he's not Ukrainian. You see, Trump is not Ukrainian. He can't get it through his head that he's got no standing on the issue. He should just go home and make America great or whatever. That, you know, whatever mess the United States has made in the Ukraine is not a mess that he can do anything about. You know, it's basically, you know, it's a lost cause. And I guess he's not very happy with that. What can he do? Well, he can try to impose sanctions on Russia. He's talking about an outrageous tariff on anyone who buys Russian energy, such as the United States. The United States can't really get along with enriched uranium from Russia. He wants to impose a huge tariff on that. Of course, he'll make an exception for the United States, but that's how silly it is. And then the other thing is that Russia now trades with its various BRICS partners and various other countries that don't use the US dollar. So the Commerce Department has no way of telling what that trade is. And how do you impose sanctions on something that you have absolutely no control over? You know, it's kind of a lost cause too. But, you know, he's pretending that he's the big guy and he gets to decide something. You know, good luck.
You mentioned the concept on the part of MAGA. It was Make America Great Again. Do you think in those in the way that they're thinking of it, is there anything about the foreign policy of the United States toward Russia, for example, which we know is one of the three superpowers? How is that going to define? Because so far we haven't seen that much of the foreign policy on the part of the Trump administration. How is it going to fit in the picture of Make America Great Again?
Well, he had some great plans, you know. He wanted to make Canada into the 51st state. He wanted to absorb Greenland. He wanted to take back the Panama Canal. He wanted to impose outrageous sanctions based on the U.S. trade deficit with each particular country. The bigger the trade deficit, the bigger the tariff. And he thought that that would do wonders for rejuvenating industry in the United States, not realizing that there's nobody to rejuvenate that industry because the industrialists are all that either dead or retired by now. There's just nobody to bring back industry in the United States except Chinese, and the Chinese are much happier working in China. So it went nowhere. MAGA went nowhere. He has not succeeded in anything at all. And now he's pretty much folded on the idea of smaller government and balancing the budget and cutting the debt and all of that. And instead, Congress just passed the big, beautiful bill, is what he called it, which is going to increase the budget deficits, raise the debt limit by a huge amount, raise federal debt by also a huge amount. And all of his domestic plans have fallen through as well because of that. And Elon Musk was supposed to cut the size of government by a trillion. That trillion became 100 billion, and now it's down to nothing because the bureaucracy pretty much prevented any of those changes from taking place. So I guess his MAGA plan is dead in the water.
The biggest part of this plan is bringing the jobs back to the United States. Is that, Dimitri, I know that you're familiar, you know this society, you know the situation in the United States, you follow that. How is that possible? Is that possible during 4 years of a presidency, you bring jobs back, you create jobs and you maintain jobs, I think, which is much more important? Or they do need a long run, a very long run strategy to see what would happen, because the way that the United States is participating in the war in Ukraine, in the Middle East, maybe soon in Africa, they're not focusing on their jobs, on the industry. Is that really a plan for them? Is that really a serious agenda on their part?
Well, it could be a serious agenda. The question is it actually achievable? Now, in order to have an industrial society, you have to have a disciplined society with a major role played by men. You see, in the human population, women are very good at various, soft kinds of activity, taking care of people mostly. They're agreeable and flexible and all of that, while men are very good at mechanical stuff, and a lot of men actually don't like working with people. A lot of men prefer working with machines and not deal with people very much. In fact, I know a lot of men who would absolutely go crazy if they had to spend the whole day dealing with people. They would start killing them. So it's better to have them work with machines. Now, the way it has, the way society has shifted in the United States because of feminism, because of families being very weak and women's rights being treated as very important while men's rights are non-existent, men are pretty much, sidelined in American society. They don't get to decide very much. And for any given job, you have to have equal number of candidates considered, male and female. For industrial jobs, you really just want to hire men. You don't want to hire women except as secretaries, and each plant might have two secretaries and 500 men, and that's normal, okay? But that is not how American society works anymore. So the way American society is, it cannot be industrialized for that reason. Another problem is medical. There's a lot of drug use. You do not want to hire stoners. You do not want to hire people who pop antidepressants to work with dangerous equipment. And any kind of manufacturing involves 100,000 ways of chopping off your fingers or bleeding to death or worse, falling into a vat of molten metal. And you don't want people on drugs anywhere near that. But the problem is that in the United States, in a lot of states, marijuana use is legalized. So you have people who smoked some pot the night before showing up for their shift at the factory and causing a huge disaster for themselves or for their coworkers. And there are a lot of places like construction sites in the US where the typical kit, the medical kit that management has to have Narcan in it, which is to save people who are overdosing on opiates, which is another huge problem. The fentanyl pandemic in the United States. Lots of people are on painkillers all the time. Also not admissible in an industrial setting. So the point is there are no Americans who are capable of revitalizing American industry. It's just not possible. The people are not there. They're either retired or dead. So it's just not going to happen.
You mentioned sanctions and the way they're trying to, we know that European Union, they're so addicted to sanctions, to put sanctions on Russia. And do you feel with this new attitude on the part of the Trump administration, they want to just literally stopping, they want to stop sending weapons to Ukraine? Is that going to change the European policy? Is that going to change their attitude with the call from Macron to Vladimir Putin?
No, of course not. Macron called Putin because he could, because Putin agreed to take his call. You know, Putin is an agreeable sort of person who likes to talk to people, keep lines of communication open. It's a typical Russian thing. The Russians will talk to everybody, friends of enemies, enemies of friends. Just the idea is the more channels of communication are open, the fewer mistakes will be made. The fuller will be the information that everybody is dealing with. So Macron had a few things to talk to Putin about. There was the whole problem of Iran having the right to a peaceful, non-military nuclear program, which is enshrined in international law. And Iran was complying with IAEA, allowing inspections. And so the whole attack on Iran by Israel and by the United States was an international crime by international criminals. From the Russian point of view, that's what it looks like. But Russia is not going to be forceful in any manner, but just basically try to get the various sides to concede what is still the fact. And the fact is that Iran has a nuclear, a uranium enrichment program with centrifuges. They're not the best in the world. They're not as good as the Russian centrifuges, but on the other hand, the United States doesn't have any centrifuges. It rents them from France. It never had the science to develop them. So that's a feather in Iran's cap that it should not be willing to give up, in spite of all these attacks and all of that Israeli nonsense. So that's something for them to talk about. And that's probably a major topic of discussion. As far as the Ukraine, it's all been said. What new information could Macron express that would interest Putin? and what could Putin said to change Macron's behavior to the extent that Macron controls his own behavior. So I don't think that actually adds up to anything at all, except Macron saying, "Hey, look, I dial the number and Putin answers. Isn't that fantastic? I'm such a great guy."
What do they want from Ukraine from now on? And is that gonna, in your opinion, with the situation that we're witnessing in Ukraine, in terms of manpower, in terms of the weapons going to Ukraine, how long does it take? We had a very, look at last night, the attacks on Ukraine and the way people were sleeping on, and you know, they were gathering in subways and these places that are secure or somehow better to sleep, to be in those places. But after all, when you look at Ukraine and the situation that the West and the United States is deciding about not sending more weapons and aids, how do you see the future of conflict in Ukraine? Is that changing? Is the West finally getting to the point to give up on their effort, their endeavor in order to defeat Russia in Ukraine?
I don't think they're giving up. I think they're running out of resources. I think Israel has eaten up all of the anti-missile, anti-ballistic missile, anti-drone rockets that they had in the inventory, that were ready to send to the Ukraine, but instead they went to Israel, and then they all got shot in Israel, and basically the truce was called. It's not really a truce. Truces are negotiated. This was just basically Trump dropping F-bombs, telling everybody to stop launching missiles at each other. But it stopped because Israel ended up defenseless, because it ran out of rockets. So now everybody's out of these stupid anti-aircraft rockets that aren't very good anyway. And so that's the change. The Ukraine is now completely defenseless, which makes the Russian initiative to destroy what's left of the military industrial complex and the army in the Ukraine, it makes it so much more effective. Russia, on the other hand, has really geared up production of these Geranium 2s, the drones, and also upgraded them a little bit so that they accelerate on the final dive towards the target, making them more difficult to intercept. So that's a major change. And in general, Russia has pretty much put out all stops on destroying what's left of industry in the Ukraine, and that's ongoing. So on the other hand, the front line is moving rather quickly these days. A few population centers are taken every day. The locals that stay behind are just absolutely happy, elated to see the Russians come in general. The most commonly asked question seems to be, what took you so long? And so that's happening. On the other hand, you know, the civil war that should be happening in the Ukraine by now is taking kind of a disappointingly long time. The Ukrainians aren't really rising up and killing Zelensky or you know, stringing him up on a light pole somewhere in Kiev. Zelensky fully deserves to end up as Mussolini did at this point, but the Ukrainians, for some reason, are not really doing a good job of that, I would say. So that's a bit of a disappointment, but I hope that it happens eventually.
Can we draw a line between Ukrainians, specifically Ukrainians in the western part of Ukraine, and the current administration in Ukraine, the Zelensky administration, or they're pretty the same sort of concept? Is there any sort of differences between the two, the public opinion in the western part of Ukraine and the administration?
Well, not really. The reason Western Ukraine was more in play during, you know, this Nazi regime era in the Ukraine is because there are people in the west of the country that actually speak a local dialect, which could be called Ukrainian. Actually, a bunch of different local dialects, and they don't really understand each other very well. So these are messy village dialects, you know, they're not really anywhere near an official language, but it was close enough. So as the whole country was told that they have to stop speaking Russian and have to start faking Ukrainian, the people who were best suited to fake it were the people from the west of the country. So they moved into Kiev and into official positions and etc. But it's all just kind of like a game. It's you know, Ukraine is more of a cult, and speaking Ukrainian is part of the cult exercise. But as soon as the cult control, the mind control ceases, they just go back to being Russian and speaking Russian.
How does Russia see Ukraine in the aftermath of any sort of Ukrainian settlement? Let's assume that finally they can get a settlement. How does Russia want to see the western part of Ukraine? A government which would collaborate with Russia somehow? Because after all, Ukraine is a country, still the western part of Ukraine is important for Russia. How do you see the way that Russia sees the western part of Ukraine, and they want to have a government to collaborate? They want to, or they maybe let it in the hand of the Europeans and Americans, because that, in my opinion, that wouldn't work for Russia, since they're fighting Ukrainians. They're fighting the West in Ukraine for more than 3 years. We're approaching 4 years of the conflict. Do you see the Russian government somehow trying to negotiate, trying to talk with the people who are not agreeing with the administration in Ukraine? Is there any sort of link between Russians and those people?
Well, this is not a new development. This territory that people are calling the Ukraine is sort of a borderland between East and West, between Russia and Europe, has been for a very long time, and troublesome for Russia for that reason. And it suffered a lot of calamities in its history. One of them was the Tatar-Mongol invasion, which basically killed everyone in Kiev, and destroyed much of the territory and depopulated it. And after that, for quite a while, it was the wild field. And eventually, the Swedes, of all people, Swedes were a superpower, European superpower at the time, and the Poles took it over. And eventually, the Russians bought Kiev back from Poland. They actually paid money to get it back. But there was a period of time where that territory was called the Wild Field. And so I think there will be a recursion of that. That area will be a lawless, depopulated place where Westerners will be prevented from entering and will be killed if they do. And that will be the only thing that Russia does with it. It won't matter what's going on there. Ethnic mafias, whatever, for the few people who are left behind. You have to understand that the only people who will be left behind there are elderly people who refuse to leave. That's it. And no industrial activity, no commerce, nothing. Just some Western mercenaries or other Western forces trying to infiltrate and getting killed in the process by the Russians, because surveillance at this point is a very well understood science. So it'll be marked off limits to everyone, until it is completely depopulated, and then it will be resettled by Russia. I think that that is the future of it.
You mean that they're going to have a governor in the in Ukraine, in the western part of Ukraine, and that would be the future? Is that, do you imagine being a country? Because right now with the situation with their economy, it's just has just collapsed, and they don't have, they don't know how to pay their people who are working for the government. And with the immigrants, with all of these difficulties they're facing with the conflict, how is that going to, is, we know that Russia is interested to help Ukraine, to help have some sort of calmness, some sort of stability in Ukraine. But how do you find the approach on the part of the Western countries, on the part of Europeans together with the United States? Do they want that?
Well, nobody asked them, specifically not the Russians. The Russians have explained what it is they want. They want this territory, which is their concern, not Europe's concern, not America's concern. They want it demilitarized. They want all the Nazis rounded up and neutralized, because after World War II, they were rounded up and locked up. But then Khrushchev came to power. Khrushchev was, his power base was in the Ukraine, and he released all of them, which is why there are all these Nazis running around the Ukraine now. It's basically Khrushchev's fault. You know, he made that horrible mistake. The Russians will not make that mistake again. The Russians at this point understand that the only good Nazi is a dead Nazi. And they're pursuing a policy of basically cleansing the territory of Nazis. And it's fairly successful. So that will probably go on. As far as Europe, Russia is not talking to Europe about the Ukraine. It has laid down its conditions. If the Ukraine, if the Europeans don't like them, so what? They have no role to play. Everybody's talking about negotiation between the United States and Russia about the Ukraine. Well, does the United States border the Ukraine? The last time I looked at a map, it didn't. So what function does it play? Its main function is to get the hell out of there and stay out. And that's what the Russians require. And that's what will eventually happen.
Then Ukraine didn't get NATO membership. And do you see any sort of membership to the European Union, or they're not going to be there as well? And we know that Fico and Orban are not happy with that concept. But after all, is that the only, I would argue, the only way that they may give some sort of hope to Ukrainians, to the western part of Ukraine, would be EU membership? How is that?
I don't see how that would provide any hope to anyone, especially not other EU countries. It would just be a very, very bad idea. Why does the EU want to absorb a completely destroyed and destitute country with run by a completely corrupt regime, and that is losing, in the process of gradually losing its population and its territory? What a prize, you know? What a wonderful thing a country like that would be for the Europeans. How much better their lives would be once they embraced this wreck of a country, and instead of spending scarce resources on their own countries, spend them all on a country where these resources will be squandered and stolen. What a wonderful plan! If I really hated the Europeans, I would say go for it.
Dmitry, do you feel that the way that the situation in the Middle East has somehow, the fight between, I'm talking about the fight between Iran and Israel, has somehow contributed to the concept of Donald Trump and the way to deal with the foreign policy of the United States? Do you think that has influenced the situation in Ukraine?
Yes. The weapons that were supposed to go to the Ukrainians went to the Israelis and got wasted trying to knock out Iranian ballistic missiles and drones, and don't exist anymore, and it'll take a long time to make more. So that's the effect. That's the effect of the Israel-Iran confrontation on the Ukrainian conflict. The Russians are grateful. BB probably got a box of chocolates from Putin.
Azerbaijan, Dmitry. Azerbaijan is a country between Iran and Russia, and located between Iran and Russia, and they were somehow letting they let the Israelis use their airspace to attack Iran, and then something came out with the tensions with Russia. Are we gonna see a new front, a new sort of tensions coming to the region in Azerbaijan, and the way that how capable are they to manipulate to do something in Azerbaijan against Iran or Russia?
Well, from the Russian point of view, there are several problems. One is that the situation in Azerbaijan itself is not really stable because the Azeri oil and gas fields are giving out, and that's a major source of revenue. Another problem with Azerbaijan is that they've been playing around with the Israelis and with NATO, and so having NATO spies right there on the Russian border, on bordering Dagestan, which is a Russian region that is very complicated and not very easy to govern from the Russian point of view. You know, that is a complication. Another complication is that the Azeri elite is very much oriented towards the West, and this specifically towards London. They all have their children learning English, going to British schools. They keep their money in City of London establishments. And they have given up some measure of control because of that to the Brits. And so the Brits are telling them to basically wreck their relationship and with Russia and bother Russia, just because the Brits would like to see the relationships between Russia and its southern neighbors go the way they went with the Ukrainians. That to the Brits is ideal. Russia at war with its neighbors. They just love to see that. So that's a problem. Another problem with Iran is that there's a corridor of land that connects Armenia to Iran, and actually cuts Azerbaijan territory in half. But Armenia is right now being run by one of these Soros creatures, whose stated purpose is to destroy Armenia and make it part of Turkey. And he's actually making huge strides in that. Armenia has lost a lot of territory to Azerbaijan, and may lose this additional corridor to Azerbaijan as well, in which case there will be a land route between Azerbaijan and Turkey. And they've been talking for a long time, but Turkey and Azerbaijan were talking about creating a system of one people, two states, because they're very similar. The languages are basically, you know, as the Azeri dialect of Turkish is basically just a dialect of Turkish, or the other way around, which are basically two dialects of the same Turkic language, very close. So that would mean that NATO's biggest NATO nation, which is Turkey, would expand And Azerbaijan would de facto become part of NATO, which is not something that Russia would particularly like and would probably want to prevent. Another issue is ethnic mafias, Azeri ethnic mafias within Russia. There are millions of Azeris living in Russia. A lot of them are very well integrated into Russian society. And some are forming ethnic enclaves and ethnic mafias and breaking Russian law and were treated as untouchable because Russia was, to some extent, trying not to upset its relationship with the Azeri government. But now the time has come for Russia to clean house. And ethnic mafias in Russia are just not going to exist for much longer. You know, there is a war against them now in Russia. And the Azeri government is, of course, very upset because these are people who provided a lot of money to Azerbaijan. Basically, they were milking Russia and sending the money to Azerbaijan. So these are respected people in Azerbaijan. And the Azeri government is, of course, very upset about that. Then, of course, there is the Aliyev clan. You see, there is a president, a perpetual president in Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev, who went to Moscow University, speaks perfect Russian. You know, he might as well be Russian, but he's got this ethnic clan running this territory, this former Soviet Socialist Republic that was pretty much handed to his father, and then his father handed it to him. And this clan really needs outside support at this point in order to remain in power, because within the country itself, it's not that popular. Their political capital is pretty well expended at this point. And so he is trying to curry favor with the Brits so that the Brits would keep him in power and to give the Brits a reason to keep him in power and to assist him. He's willing to wreck his relationship with Russia. And so it's a very complicated situation, very difficult to untangle, and very important because of the North-South corridor, which if it's a rail corridor, would run one of the arms of it, would have to run through Azerbaijan and Armenia at this point, and then Iran. There are other ways to get to Iran, though. One is across the Caspian. And speaking of the Caspian, it's an inland sea that by agreement is controlled only by the countries that border it. But if Azerbaijan becomes kind of one with Turkey and becomes part of NATO, then suddenly NATO has a voice in what's done with that sea. And that to Russia is, and to other countries that border the Caspian, would be not acceptable.
Yeah, I was somehow surprised by the role of British government in Azerbaijan. How do you evaluate the way that Turkey and the United Kingdom are somehow collaborating or against each other in Azerbaijan?
I think they're collaborating.
So what is the main goal? What do they want to achieve in Azerbaijan? It's making some sort of force. We know that Israelis are there. They're trying to keep Israelis in Azerbaijan in order to somehow intimidate Iran or doing some their job there, and they're trying to gather information from Iran. But what is about the Russia? What's the problem with Russia, and how do they want? Because at the same time, you cannot keep. I don't know why Turkey is somehow collaborating with the United Kingdom. What's in it for them?
Well, Turkey is a country that is flawed in many ways and has huge problems. It has a huge refugee problem. It has a huge Kurdish problem. It hasn't been able to fully integrate them. The Syrian refugees are a huge problem for it. It can threaten the European Union by threatening to send all these refugees into the European Union and flood the European Union with refugees anytime. So it can use them as a weapon against the European Union. It keeps them that way. That's one of the reasons that it stirs the pot in Syria to make it so that those refugees can't go back. I think that's part of the reason. It has high inflation. It has kind of a stagnant economy. It depends on Russian tourism for quite a bit. It's one of the prime tourist destinations for Russia. Russia has a shortage of warm water beaches and uses turkeys. At the same time, it entertains this irredentist fantasy of what it's calling the Great Turan, a great Turkish or Turkic area that includes Turkey, that includes Azerbaijan, that possibly includes Central Asian republics. It tries to cultivate expat communities, making them as Turkish as possible and refusing to integrate, for instance, in Germany, which has a big Turkish population. So it has these fantasies of rekindling the Ottoman Empire in some form, and Britain is playing that up and saying, we'll assist you, but you have to help us. What we want you to do is wreck the relationship between Azerbaijan and Russia. And if you try to do that, then that will be helpful to us, and we'll help you. So basically, from the point of view of Turkey, what they're trying to do is build some kind of an amorphous empire that includes Azerbaijan. From the point of view of the Brits, they're doing their usual nasty business, just basically what they used to call the Great Game. I guess they're still calling it the Great Game, which is complicate life for Russia. And that's what they're doing.
The collaboration, by the way, Dmitry, is so dangerous because the outcome of the collaboration was what has happened in Syria. These people, they gathered all these people, radical jihadists in Syria, and we know that in the Central Asia, going to Azerbaijan and then Turkey, these people are somehow much powerful than before. And do you feel that after all, there would be some sort of collaboration on the part of Russia and Iran to deal with it? Because it's about the security of both countries and the way that they may somehow influence the Iran and Russia by these movements that are, because Ukrainians, look at the way that Ukrainians were somehow training these people in Idlib and collaborating with them, and the communication between these people and Ukraine that we know is run by the British intelligence and British government. They're so much powerful in Ukraine. How is that going to influence the future, the vision on the part of Iran and Russia toward this sort of movement that you mentioned, the collaboration between the United Kingdom and Turkey together with Azerbaijan?
Well, it's unclear how that's going to unfold, but I think that there's a common theme to all of that, which is Central Asian republics, which are relatively well run, Azerbaijan, which is relatively well run, getting rid of their undesirables by sending them to Russia or to Syria. All of these people that are quote unquote terrorists or criminals, they try to expel. They try to push in the direction of one border or another. Now, Russia is the easiest for, or has been the easiest for the Central Asian republics, because there's a special no visa requirement for former Soviet Socialist republics. So they go and they get a permit and are allowed to live and work and form ethnic enclaves and form ethnic mafias. And the Russians, and this has been going on for ever since the Soviet Union fell apart, with sporadic efforts to fight back And now Russia is getting very serious about it. Now Russia is really tightening its immigration controls. So in the future, migrants that come to work will only be able to stay while they have an official job and paying taxes, and they won't be able to bring their families with them, etc. Lots of requirements. Migrant workers who have brought their families and somehow obtained Russian citizenships face some amount of scrutiny, etc. So all of that is happening in Russia. And so all of that kind of human refuse is now sloshing towards other countries, such as Syria. And so that's really bad for former Syria. That's bad news.
Yeah. Dmitry, we have the BRICS summit here in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro. And we know that if we want to have a better situation in the future, we're going to have a better financial system, a better communication in terms of the economy of these countries who are trying to do something within BRICS. In your opinion, what are the main goals to be achieved in the near future, not in a long run? In a long run, there has to be some sort of plan in a long run, and they have it. But for the near future, what do they see coming out of BRICS that could change the situation with the West, that could bring some sort of balance between the East and the West, and the way that they're somehow they have dominated the financial system for such a long time? And how do you see BRICS coming in and doing something in the near future?
Well, I think that the major problem, the major success, is that now BRICS countries trade with each other in their own currencies to a large extent. The big problem is that various risk assessments, to some extent, and valuations of commodities still come from places like London and New York, and are based on the U.S. dollar, one way or another. So that I think is the next frontier for BRICS to deal with, because as Western countries kind of fade from view as far as the BRICS nations are concerned, the non-Western part of the world continues to grow and trade with itself, and the Western part of the world continues to shrink and dream of going to war with Russia or whatever crazy thing they're thinking about that nobody really wants to talk about. It is very important that the BRICS nations figure out how to price things in their own currencies instead of the US dollar. I hope that that's going to become a major topic of discussion among them, because the other thing is that, you know, they've done a great deal to dollar proof themselves and euro proof themselves, but are they really ready for some climatic event like the US dollar suddenly becoming toxic to the extent that dollar-based trade just stops? Are they ready for that? Will that cause a huge amount of disruption? Or are there emergency plans in place? I would say that those emergency plans are very important at this point.
India, is India going to help to facilitate the situation, or you see India still as a wild card on the part of the United States? They can do something with India.
Well, I think that it's a question of what India can do with the United States. Indians are now the richest ethnic group in the United States. They've displaced the Jews. Consider that. Used to be that the Jews were the richest in America. Now it's the Indians, and you can see that, you know, during the last presidential election, we had a bunch of Indians popping out. You know, there was Ramaswamy running for president for a while. There was Kamala Harris, half Indian, running for president for a while, and the vice president's wife, of course, is Indian. And they went to India and you know, made their bows and all of that, and were graciously received as fellow Indians. So the United States is, to, you know, we used to talk about the Israeli lobby or the Jewish lobby in the United States. Well, that is kind of fading a little bit. And what we should be talking about is the Indian lobby in the United States, because the Indians are pretty well organized, and it's a huge, powerful country, unlike Israel, which is, you know, a tiny little nubby of a country that everybody can pretty much ignore, unless Americans kind of treat it as their own special colony. You know, India is too big to be, at this point, to be anyone's colony. It makes its own its own moves. But in terms of whether it's East and West, well, there are a lot of Indians in the West, and it straddles the two hemispheres, and so things are complicated.
Do you think that China and India were capable of putting their differences aside, or we're going to see that sort of situation between the two countries boiling up again?
I don't think they'll boil up. I think that India, well, India is sort of funny because it has the pure capitalist model pretty much for its economic development. On the other hand, it has entire provinces that are run by communists, and so it's very diverse and complicated, but doesn't really have a common scheme, and that hampers its economic development. I don't know to what extent they realize that that's a problem, but China, on the other hand, combines some elements of free market capitalism with communist political control. And that is a very successful model that they copied from Stalin and improved. Stalin came up with absolutely the most successful economic model the world has ever seen. And the Soviet Union saw just absolutely ridiculously high rates of growth that nobody, not even the Chinese, were able to repeat. But China has copied that model and made some improvements on it. So now it's the Chinese model, not the Russian model, which the Russians abandoned by, kind of by accident because of Khrushchev. And so India could sort of start looking in that direction, I would say, if they could. You know, they're very much influenced at the educational level, etc., by the West, not so much by the East. And closer relations with Russia and closer relations with China would probably help India a great deal, much more than its traditional relationship with Great Britain or with the United States.
Is the relationship between the Great Britain, the United Kingdom, and India is that still complicated? Do you see any sort of leverage on the part of the United Kingdom, any sort of influence, let's put it this way, that they have on India?
No, I think at this point, India and Pakistan pretty much can run the United Kingdom if they wanted to. Question is, do they really want to?
No. Dimitri, before wrapping up, let us know how can we support your work and your website. You mentioned that you have a new article on your website. Go ahead.
Yes, please go and read it. I think you'll enjoy it. It's an homage to Kurt Vonnegut, whom I like a lot, a great American writer. And I wrote it to mark the 4th of July, the Independence Day. Traditionally, on this day, alien spaceships bomb and destroy the White House. I don't know if it'll happen this time, but stay tuned.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dimitri. Great pleasure.
Thank you, Nima. Bye-bye.
Bye.